Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Program in Scripture and the Arts in the Department of Religion at Boston University. Speaking will be Christopher Ricks, co-director of the Editorial Institute and Warren Professor of the Humanities at Boston University, also professor of poetry at Oxford University. Professor Ricks' lecture is titled Faith in Eliot. We begin with an introduction by English Department Professor Matthew Smith.
While he has the care and focus of a specialist, his range is astonishing, including essential edited editions of Milton, Houseman, the Brownings, Tennyson, Eliot, not even to mention the new Oxford Book of Victorian Verse, the Oxford Book of British Verse. If Ricks's work consisted of these edited editions alone, he would, of course, have laurels enough to rest upon. But alongside these are full-length studies and essay collections for which he is at least as well known. To mention a few, Milton's Grand Style, Keats and Embarrassment, T.S. Eliot and Prejudice, Essays in Appreciation, Dylan's Vision of Sin, and my own favorite, one that's meant a great deal to me as a scholar of modern drama, and one I think one of the very few works on Beckett written in a style suited to the subject, is the great work Beckett's Dying Words. Elected the Oxford Professor of Poetry in 2004, and serving here at BU as the Warren Professor of the Humanities, Ricks is continuing to work on so many projects, I hesitate to say what the most recent is. But one of the most recent is his co-directorship of the selected edition of the work of James Fitzjames Stephen, for which he won a generous Mellon Foundation grant. And of course, he's also undertaking a full critical edition of T.S. Eliot's Complete Poems to be published by Faber and Faber. We are all looking forward to that. So on behalf of the program in Scripture and the Arts, I'm extremely pleased to welcome Professor Christopher Ricks.
Thank you. Well, I just want to start with two letters. And the first is a letter which has been quoted in the immediate wake of Eliot's death. Bonamy Dobray, a friend and professor, friend of Eliot's, professor in England, had a large correspondence with Eliot, and he wrote a memorial piece when Eliot died, so that in 1965 part of this letter was issued, but only part, and Mrs. Eliot quite promptly decided that she didn't want the letters to be quoted and used except within a full edition of the letters. So that this is rather strange material that for a while was available for scholars to quote and then ceased to be so. And it's a letter from 1936 to Bonamy Dobray, and it's about the epigraph, or rather one of the two epigraphs to Sweeney Agonistes, the epigraph from St. John of the Cross, "Hence the soul cannot be possessed of the divine union until it has divested itself of the love of created beings." A dark and in some ways punitive thought for many of us. Dobray must have taken this up with Eliot, so Eliot writes to Dobray, "The doctrine that in order to arrive at the love of God one must divest oneself of the love of created beings was thus expressed by St. John of the Cross, you know. That is, a man who was writing primarily not for you and me, but for people seriously engaged in pursuing the way of contemplation. It is only to be read in relation to that way. That is, merely to kill one's human affections will get one nowhere. It would be only to become rather more completely a living corpse than most people are. But the doctrine is fundamentally true, I believe, or to put your belief in your way, that only through the love of created beings can we approach the love of God, that I do believe to be untrue." OK? capital letters in the letter at that point. Whether we mean by that domestic and friendly affections or a more comprehensive love of the neighbour, of humanity in general, I don't think that ordinary human affections are capable of leading us to the love of God, but rather that the love of God is one capable of informing, intensifying, and elevating our human affections, which otherwise may have little to distinguish them from the natural affections of animals. Try looking at it from that end of the glass. And as for the dogma of original sin, do you really think that that compels us to deny that men have, and here he's quoting Dobre, a deal of selflessness, generosity, fellow feeling, caritas, followed by three question marks? It is for me, there's more of the letter, of course, it's a letter which ends, yours perpetually. Not something I would ever dare to write myself at the end of a letter. As you know, writing yours ever is a month later you've quarrelled inalienably with the person who was yours ever quite recently. Yours perpetually is sure of something very much larger about the afterlife. So I find that I find it in its way a bleak but thrilling letter, but I'm now going to quote a letter to Miss Alice Quinn, age 16. So 19th of February, 1952, and this is for me, I'm not a Christian, but this is for me a more deeply Christian letter than the one that has a theological attention. Dear Miss Alice Quinn, I do not often answer letters because I am too busy, but I liked your letter and I'm glad that you are at Catholic school. I cannot tell you how to concentrate because that is something I have been trying to learn all my life. There are spiritual exercises in concentration, but I am not the person to teach what I am trying to learn. All I know is that if you are interested enough and care enough, then you concentrate. But nobody can tell you how to start writing. The only good reason for writing is that one has to write. You ask seven questions. No one event in one's childhood starts one writing, no doubt a number of events and other causes. That remains mysterious. My advice to up-and-coming writers is don't write at first for anyone but yourself. It doesn't matter how many or how few universities one goes to, what matters is what one learns, either at universities or by oneself. My favourite essay, I think, is my essay on Dante, not because I think I know about Dante, but because I loved what I wrote about. The Wasteland is my most famous work, and therefore perhaps will prove the most important, but it is not my favourite. I am interested to hear that Kunitz and Haycraft say that I prefer to associate with nobility and church dignitaries, but I like to know every sort of person, including nobility and dignitaries. I also like to know policemen, plumbers, and people. One does not always need to know a subject very well in order to teach it. What one does know is how to teach anything. I went to a very good school, which no longer exists, in St. Louis, Missouri, where I was well taught in Latin, Greek, French, and elementary mathematics. Those are the chief subjects worth learning at school, and I'm glad that I was well taught in these subjects instead of having to study such subjects as T.S. Eliot. At the university, I studied too many subjects and mastered none. If you study Latin, Greek, French, mathematics, and the essentials of the Christian faith, that is the right beginning. I like living in London because it is my city, and I'm happier there than anywhere else. With best wishes, T.S. Eliot. Now, I look forward to these letters which will bring out the humanity of Eliot repeatedly. There are things in his poetry which at least seem to be inhumane. That is, he so much believed in the achievement that he attributed to Stendhal, that is, of understanding not only human feelings, but human illusions of feeling, that he was very, very quick to rebuke in himself and in others, what seemed to him to be illusions of feeling. But a letter like this seems to have very, very direct feeling. I think it was very good of Mrs. Eliot to permit this letter to be printed in a volume of David Hockney's Alphabet to raise money for children, essentially. And this is the kind of thing I think one can look forward to. So there are two letters that have to do with scripture. I'll say something about then faith in Eliot. I was, of course, wanting you to think it's both the faith that we have in him. I mean, that is, what kind of faith should we have in Eliot as a thinker, as an artist, as a poet, as a human being? And partly, of course, the faith that he himself has, faith to some degree as challenged by his sense of his art as by his sense of religion. That is, again and again in the criticism, he comes back to the thought that this may all be pointless. It may all be pointless. And it's characteristic of very great artists to believe that and to be haunted by it, but in the end to have faith that it is not pointless and so on. So it's in his art, faith in his art and in his powers, and of course the faith that we have in him as readers. So I want to start with St. Mark. Jesus said unto him, if thou canst believe, all things are possible to him that believeth. And straightway the father of the child cried out and said with tears, Lord, I believe. Help thou my unbelief. Now, I've always found it mysteriously beautiful. That is, you expect that the thought will be, I believe, help my belief. But what it asks is, help thou my unbelief. And there are clearly immediately two different things that that can mean. It can mean my unbelief is actually needing support because it is a condition of true believing. Since to believe is not to know, anything which tells you that you know threatens belief. And when Roger Shattuck, our great former colleague in this university, wrote a book on forbidden knowledge, it was partly about knowledge that we should not know, of the kind that the Marquis de Sade specialized in, and it was partly about the truth that is in the idea that knowledge is itself forbidden as incompatible with faith. If you know, you cannot be held to exercise faith. And the Christian religion does not have a monopoly, of course, of believing in faith, but it's very, very strong that what you have to have is faith. If you knew, you would not have faith, and so on. So the Tertullian, it is certain because it is impossible, is about helping unbelief, it seems to me. And there's a clear relation between that and the fact that in appreciation of the arts, you cannot know. You can never prove a judgment about the arts. The best that you can do is make good a case, substantiate a case, give evidence that you know will never amount to proof. If you claim that you can prove, you are wrong. If you claim that you cannot give evidence, you are wrong. So that what Hazlitt, when Hazlitt talks about what we are doing when we appreciate the arts, we are giving reasons for the faith that is in us. But we must not suppose that the reasons amount to proof, because faith is not proof. To take things on faith is to take them as trust, and the act of trust is incompatible with knowing. My father, who was a strange man, had one principle, which was that you must never bet on a certainty. If you actually know what is the case, you do not bet somebody. No gentleman bets on a certainty. So Dad only ever betted on uncertainties and regularly lost. The people that he bet with were not gentlemen and thought it was absolutely all right to bet on a certainty. But after all, Pascal's wager is betting not on a certainty, and as is the entire wager that anybody might engage in with faith. Giving reasons for the faith that is in you. Dylan, you'll remember, since Chrissy tells me it's obligatory that I mention Bob Dylan on this occasion, the author Ezra Pound and T.S. Eliot fighting in the captain's tower while Calypso singers laugh at them and fishermen hold flowers, Dylan very beautifully in Precious Angel sings, now the spiritual warfare, flesh and blood breaking down, you've either got faith or you've got unbelief. The word unfaith tried to get a hold in the language and failed. It's very strange that we got faithful and unfaithful with perfect equanimity, but we haven't got faith and unfaith. There isn't an opposite of faith. You've either got faith or you've got unbelief, so that you're already slightly having to skew all thinking about belief and faith and so on. I think Dylan is right to think that the opposite of a believer, the opposite of a believer is an unbeliever, but the word belief wouldn't do what he wants here. It's not you've either got belief or you've got unbelief. No, you've either got faith or you've got unbelief. The word faith is very rare in Eliot. It comes in the poems in Cousin Nancy, very darkly, about Arnold and Emerson, Matthew and Waldo, guardians of the faith. That's sardonic. It comes unsardonically in Song for Simeon, kept faith and fast, provided for the poor. And it comes in East Coker, I think, very beautifully. There is yet faith. I mean, the Pauline memory is very clear. There is yet faith. but the faith and the hope and the love are all in the waiting. And they're not only, I think, in the waiting, but also to some degree in the doubting because of what faith is. And the word belief is extremely rare in Eliot. The noun belief comes nowhere in Eliot's poems. If you think how important belief is to him personally and in his religion and in other respects, and how often it's discussed in the critical prose, very, very deeply and very, very interestingly, its absence from the poems is, I think, a very, very striking one. I'm going to take a few minutes to read from a very great poet in whom T.S. Eliot took very little interest. And it's one of the big mysteries of Eliot's sense of our literature that Wordsworth meant so extraordinarily little to him. I mean, he said better things about Wordsworth probably than anybody in the room has said, but compared with the profundity of acumen when it came to a great many other poets, Wordsworth is oddly not really existent for him. But this is Wordsworth from the essay supplementary to the preface, and it's a reminder of a lot of the considerations in the matter of faith. It's a longish extract, but it's extremely beautiful. As poetry is most just to its own divine origin, when it administers the comforts and breathes the spirit of religion, they who have learnt to perceive this truth and who betake themselves to reading verse for sacred purposes must be preserved from numerous illusions to which the two classes of readers whom we've been considering are liable. But as the mind grows serious from the weight of life, the range of its passions is contracted accordingly, and its sympathies become so exclusive that many species of high excellence wholly escape or but languidly excite its notice. Besides, men who read from religious or moral inclinations, even when the subject is of that kind which they approve, are beset with misconceptions and mistakes peculiar to themselves. Attaching so much importance to the truths which interest them, they are prone to overrate the authors by whom those truths are expressed and enforced. They come prepared to impart so much passion to the poet's language that they remain unconscious how little, in fact, they receive from it. And on the other hand, religious faith is to him who holds it so momentous a thing, and error appears to be attended with such tremendous consequences, that if opinions touching upon religion occur which the reader condemns, he not only cannot sympathize with them, however animated the expression, but there is for the most part an end put to all satisfaction and enjoyment. And the passage continues, I think, with very great acumen to talk about what we often deny, that you are in some ways peculiarly disadvantaged if you concur with a poem. In some ways, you're peculiarly disadvantaged. Now, faith was given to man, Wordsworth says, that his affections, detached from the treasures of time, might be inclined to settle upon those of eternity, the elevation of his nature which this habit produces on earth being to him a presumptive evidence of a future state of existence. But only a presumptive evidence is the argument. So you have a very strong sense, I think, of what faith is, including a faith in poetry, but an understanding, as I say, that sharing the beliefs and convictions expressed in the poem is not simply an advantage to you. And this is the subject, repeatedly, of Eliot's attention to belief. Almost everybody in the room will know that the most extended discussion of this by Eliot is in a note to section 2 of his book on Dante, which is then taken up in full into the selected essays. And in that note, he argues with I.A. Richards about belief. He says at first, "I deny, in short, that the reader must share the beliefs of the poet in order to enjoy the poetry fully." And he talks about how damaging it will be if that were really the case. He says dryly about himself, people have observed this, "I'm sure that our capacity for enjoying either poem would be mutilated. Mr. Richards' statement that a certain writer has effected a complete severance between his poetry and all beliefs is to me incomprehensible." But it's incomprehensible because he's a certain writer. Rather good to speak of yourself in the third person as a certain writer when you're absolutely certain who it was about. "If you deny the theory that full poetic appreciation is possible without belief in what the poet believed, you deny the existence of poetry, as well as of criticism. And if you push this denial to its conclusion, you'll be forced to admit that there's very little poetry that you can appreciate, and that your appreciation of it will be a function of your philosophy or theology or something else. If, on the other hand, I push my theory to the extreme, I find myself in as great a difficulty. And then he talks about what it means to say that you can understand this poetry without sharing its beliefs, and he knows the real problem about what understand would mean there. In short, both the view I have taken in this essay and the view which contradicts it are, if pushed to the end, what I call heresies. Not, of course, in the theological, but in a more general sense. Each is true only within a limited field of discourse, but unless you limit fields of discourse, you can have no discourse at all. So that he's talking about what William Empson very profoundly calls the fact that life involves maintaining oneself between contradictions that cannot be solved by analysis. Now, we know that perfectly well because of antithetical proverbs. We know that each of them, it's not that each is a half-truth, it's that each is half of the truth. It's not half-true. It is half of the truth that he who hesitates is lost, and it is half of the truth that you had better look before you leap. You cannot solve that by analysis. You can only consider this to be a situation in which absence is making the heart grow fonder, instead of being out of sight, out of mind. They're both true, but and the judgment is in deciding which is the one that pertains on this occasion. I've tried to make clear some of the difficulties inhering in my own theory, Eliot says. Actually, and as soon as somebody says actually, you know they're going to throw everything away. A, this American has become totally English because Americans don't say actually. And secondly, there's going to be some contradiction. Actually, one probably has more pleasure in the poetry when one shares the beliefs of the poet. Now, of course, pleasure is then called on to do a good deal of work. I deny, in short, that the poet must share the beliefs of the poet in order to enjoy the poetry fully, but enjoying it fully is not identified with pleasure, and there's a certain kind of pleasure that you get if you share the beliefs all right. On the other hand, immediately, because Eliot is very good at having two hands, on the other hand, there is a distinct pleasure in enjoying poetry as poetry when one does not share the beliefs, analogous to the pleasure of mastering other men's philosophical systems. Now, the great contribution I think that Eliot made to this is one that I don't think anybody has advanced with, and I have proved entirely incapable of advancing myself with it. I think it is true, and I do not understand how to apply it. And it goes like this. It's several places in Eliot. This next passage, for instance, is from an essay that he didn't collect. I'll point out when they're not collected to give some suggestion of how important it will be when these things are widely available, not available only to the scholars who have been able to get hold of something in a great library, but widely available. We can say, I think, that belief is not a simple act of the mind, of such a kind that to believe in the world of the schoolmen and to believe in a mechanistic universe are, as acts of believing, identical. We might even suggest that believing changes from age to age, although no age will possess the terms in which to define the difference between its believing and that of any previous age. And he keeps worrying at this until he despairs of it. That is, he circles around it. That's a note on Two Odes of Cowley. It comes in the Clark Lectures, The Varieties of Metaphysical Poetry, when he says, he's comparing Donne and Cowley. In Donne, some of these ideas are of contemporary science, some of contemporary theology, but they are all entertained on an equal footing, and this is typical of his time. In the mind of Cowley, many of these ideas no longer find entrance. What are left are certainly more coherent and orderly, but are not believed by himself with the same intensity with which the ideas of Donne were entertained by himself. It is difficult to expound my meaning here, for the subject is really the subject for a book on the history of belief. I suggest to psychologists that belief alters from age to age, so that when a person asserts, I believe X, we must take into account the position in time of the author of this statement. That is, this is a recurrent motif for Eliot, because it's not about the philosophy of belief, it's about the history of belief. And history of belief, he gave a capital H to history, as well as a capital B to belief. He says, for instance, to limit ourselves to Christians is elsewhere, to Christian belief, there is religious verse in the 13th century, in the 17th, and in the 19th centuries. But what he says is that what Christina Rossetti is doing when she believes in the Trinity is not the same as what Donne is doing when he believes in it. So it's not that the doctrine has changed, it's that, what the mind is doing when it believes has changed. Now that seems to me prima facie extremely plausible, that since everything changes in history, I don't see why belief should be different. But we don't have, I don't know of any scholar, I'd be very happy to hear from people, of any scholar who has seriously prosecuted this thought about the history of belief. It rather falls between the interstices, doesn't it? As rather the history of ideas, simply as the Journal of the History of Ideas, has ceased to have it the power that it had when I was in my 20s and 30s. It's as if different specialisms have come in there. And he will say the same about Ramon Fernandez in relation to Newman. And he will say, I think, that one of the most frightening things that he wrote about belief, and he himself speaks of it as frightening, is this. The reflection that what we believe is not merely what we formulate and subscribe to, but the behavior is also belief. And that even the most conscious and developed of us live also at the level on which belief and behavior cannot be distinguished, is one that may, once we allow our imagination to play upon it, be very disconcerting. And then he thinks about the word disconcerting and realizes that too needs to be made more severe. It gives an importance to our most trivial pursuits, to the occupation of our every minute, which we cannot contemplate long without the horror of nightmare. And the being disconcerted has turned into something else there, very importantly. Now, you will, several of you will have been thinking, well, the entertain-believe distinction is a crucial one, and what I would draw your attention to is William Empson's accounts of this. Empson and Eliot, though Eliot generously published Empson's poems when Eliot, in his capacity as an important poetry person at Faber and Faber, there was a real tension between the two of them, all right. But on this, I think they are at one. Here are a few quotations from Empson. On Fielding, he does not find relativism alarming because he feels that to understand codes other than your own is likely to make your judgment better. Then again, it strikes me that modern critics, whether as a result of the neo-Christian movement or not, have become oddly resistant to admitting that there is more than one code of morals in the world. Whereas the central purpose of reading imaginative literature is to accustom oneself to this basic fact. It seems to me, another excerpt, it seems to me that the chief function of imaginative literature is to make you realize that other people are very various, many of them quite different from you, with different systems of value as well. Or third one, the main purpose of reading imaginative literature is to grasp a wide variety of experience, imagining people with codes and customs very unlike our own. Now, if I were to pick up some of Matt's point about the plight of the humanities, it has been bad lately. The value of literature has been based so often on whether or not it corroborates what the writer about it believes. That is, this is a good poem because it supports or does not support the class war. It's a good poem because it validates or does not validate Freudian or Lacanian accounts of the world. Now, I think it is very valuable in literature to help to confirm and corroborate things that you believe, but that is only half of the truth, and the other half is that it is very valuable in literature to bring home to you sympathetically that people have very different judgments from your own. I'll tell an anecdote which some of you will have heard me tell before. My oldest child, who is soon to be 50, when I asked him about whether the vicar had visited his home in the village where he and his wife live, said, to my surprise, "No, but since the subject has come up, I ought perhaps to tell you that I have been received into the Church of England." Now, judge of my astonishment. I'd given this child a perfectly healthy upbringing, and here he is entering the Church of England. I did, of course, extend my hand and shake him warmly by the hand, and we haven't much talked about it since. I did not cut him out of my will, as is widely rumoured, and so on. But there are only two ways in which you ever get sympathetic access to systems of belief that are not your own. One is through people whom you love, your friends, your family, and the other is through the arts. These are the two great sources of imaginative sympathy. It doesn't have to take the form that George Eliot thought it had to take, but without these, we are perpetually going to be valuing only that which we concur with. And being taught to value things that we do not concur with, to entertain beliefs which you may never hold.
Sometimes, of course, entertaining them sympathetically moves you to come to believe them, and there's nothing wrong with that. But if the only, it'd be a bit like having no friends with whom one. I mean, the assumption of many of my friends is that nobody could have a friend who voted for Senator McCain. I mean, it's sort of widely out there. It needs a positive effort of imagination within certain circles to think something other. Do you know what I mean? To think that somebody can have beliefs that are very, very deeply different from your own. Now, things from the prose. I can't give much of an anthology of this. What I want to draw your attention to is how early Eliot is saying certain things which he does not exactly explicitly repudiate, but which certainly complicate our understanding. 1917, 10 years before he enters the Church of England, is received into the Church of England. He was explicit that he had been brought up outside the Christian fold as a Unitarian. I think it should be open to Unitarians to deny that they are outside the Christian fold. That is, whether the Trinity is indispensable to Christianity is not something about which either party should be simply believed, it seems to me. There's a genuine argument on both sides of that. But I want to draw your attention, for instance, to things that he said in the International Journal of Ethics in July 1917. He says, he's talking about philosophy and religion, which Collingwood, he's reviewing Collingwood. Collingwood is essentially identifying philosophy and theology in the book called Religion and Philosophy. Eliot says, "But philosophy depends upon the whole course of history, not upon any particular signal and unique facts, and its freedom of interpretation is limited only by its obligation to exclude nothing. Religion, on the other hand, or at least the Christian religion, depends upon one important fact. Philosophy may show, if it can, the meaning of the statement that Jesus was the Son of God, but Christianity, Orthodox Christianity, must base itself upon a unique fact that Jesus was born of a virgin, a proposition which is either true or false, its terms having a fixed meaning." Now, I wish that Eliot, in the course of a long and distinguished career as a thinker and poet, had ever explained to us why it was that he ceased to believe that. It seems to me that he does cease to believe it because it's incompatible with his notion that Christianity is valuable because it's repeatedly able to develop into something which people can continue to believe. And I don't think he would later have held to this any more than he would later have held to his saying in 1917 when he reviews William Temple, later, of course, to be the primate. He quotes William Temple. "But to agree with the author, we must not only concede that intellect, imagination, science, and art would reach their culmination in the apprehension and contemplation of the supreme principle of the universe, adequately embodied and incarnate, but that this culmination is found in Christianity. And might it not be maintained that however poor our lives would be without it, religion is only one form of satisfaction among others, rather than the culminating satisfaction of all satisfactions?" Now, that is a very perilous thing to believe. In the Church of England, you're allowed to believe almost anything, as you know. And William Empson once praised the Church of England for having kept Christianity at bay. wonderful thought and so on. The marvellous exchange, let me say, Geoffrey Hill interviewing the Archbishop of Canterbury and being interviewed by the Archbishop of Canterbury in Oxford in the summer. And it was wonderful to hear Geoffrey talking and saying all the time, "Yes, yes, yes, absolutely right. You're absolutely..." And I've known Geoffrey for 50 years. I've never heard him say yes, let alone yes, 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 let alone absolutely right. So they were conferring in this wonderful way, and the occasion ended. It was very, very beautiful to see I keep calling him the primate. I like the thought of him as a primate. I mean, which he is. So there's Rowan Williams, whom people regularly referred to as Rowan Atkinson. There's really only there's only one Rowan out there who's famous, really. And so, anyway, the end of the thing was a plaintive question from the floor. Is there anything to be hopeful about, Geoffrey, that Rowan Williams is the Archbishop of Canterbury? Profound round of applause, in which I'm afraid I didn't join. Then a pause. Geoffrey Hill said, "And that I'm still writing, and writing better than ever." Huge round of applause. Now, I thought, I mean, is not Christian humility, I mean, isn't it a religion which takes a good deal on Christian humility and so on? Anyway, you know, what I want, that's not entirely beside the point. What I'm getting at is statements by Eliot which will have to form part of our sustained thinking about him, which have hitherto not been available. They could be available to the scholar who will this and that, though some of them are, in absolutely legendary phrase, not in Gallup. If they're not in Gallup's bibliography, this wonderful feat of scholarship from Yale, if they're not in Gallup's bibliography, nobody has known of them. And one of the things that Ron Shuhart is doing is finding things which are not in Gallup. It's an immense tribute to Gallup. Here's this from Eliot, which should, I think, be met with a certain surprise. It's 5 years after he becomes a British citizen and enters the Church of England. The intellectual case for Christianity is very strong, and one which demands a good deal of study. A great deal of study. And, to be quite fair, there is a good case to be made out for atheism as well. Now, I would like him on some occasion to have explained to us why it was only a good case and not a very strong case and so on. It's odd, an odd inattention. That seems to me a terrifically betraying remark. I think it betrays something very good, but there's some duty of reconciliation, I think, that would fall upon him. He had previously tried to say that atheists, that you can't become an atheist unless you adopt another religion. He said, as we become used to atheism, we recognize that atheism is often merely a variety of Christianity. For one only ceases to be a Christian by being something else definite, a Buddhist, a Mohammedan, a Brahmin. Now, it's not clear to me why that's the case. It isn't at all. It seems to me the atheist is the opposite of a theist. A theist believes there is a God. Now, we don't use the word theism for that because of a particular moment in intellectual and spiritual life in which theism came to mean pretty sure there's a God, but not altogether sure that the Christian God is morally and spiritually satisfactory, so that it gets sucked in towards deism and so on. But essentially, the opposite of an atheist is a theist. I say this because I regularly have good-natured disagreements with John Silber, who says that my insistence that an atheist does not claim to know flies in the face of how we use the word. It's an unjust accusation that the atheist claims to know. The atheist says, in my case, that I do not believe there is a God. The theist, the Christian, believes there is a God. The Christian who knows there is a God is destined for a particular circle in the hell in which I don't believe. That is, you are not to know these things because faith is asked of you. What Americans do, you know, we've just heard in the paper today, haven't we, that every country must be governed from the middle. Not only must your country be governed from the middle, but every country must be governed from the middle. So Americans tend to, if they're concerned much with this, call themselves agnostic because you can't be altogether wrong. I mean, you're just saying that you don't know about it. It's a sort of decent centrist liberal position or extreme socialist or whatever you're going to call it. What happens, I think, is that people who don't believe there is a God should call themselves atheists. They will get hate mail. If you call yourself an atheist on the radio in this country, you get some hate mail. You don't get beaten to a pulp, but you get hate mail. But nevertheless, the atheist is no more claiming to know than the Christian is claiming. That is, my belief is that there isn't anything that it makes sense for me to think of as a God, and so on. And I wish more people who hold that position didn't have to say, well, actually, well, I'm sort of agnostic about it, and so on. Why I'm saying it. Here I have a great sheaf of things, of which I think the most important in some way is the essay that Eliot never collected that's called Religion Without Humanism. It's his best statement of why religion needs humanism, and it's well worth looking at. He published it all right, but he didn't collect it. It's 1930. The danger, a very real one, of religion without humanism. And it ends, he says, humanism without religion, I respect it but believe it to be sterile. Religion without humanism produces the vulgarities and the political compromises of Roman Catholicism. And he moves on to some other kind of awful things and so on in that way. In the essay on Revelation, that's another, I think, the profoundly important statement, is the introduction to the book edited by John Bailey, and Eliot says he's writing the introduction because he's not a theologian. I take for granted that Christian revelation is the only full revelation, and that the fullness of Christian revelation resides in the essential fact of the incarnation, in relation to which all Christian revelation is to be understood. Now, the incarnation at that point is not the same as a virgin birth. That right? There could have been an incarnation that was not by the means of virgin birth and so on. Eliot goes on, the division between those who accept and those who deny Christian revelation, I take to be the most profound division between human beings. It does not merely go deeper than divisions by political faith, divisions of class or race. It is different in kind and cannot be measured by the same scale. The obduracy of this, I think, is at once thrilling and chilling, or it is to me, and especially the assumption, of course, that Christian revelation is the only full revelation. He said in the Criterion, praising Middleton Murray slightly to his surprise, to his own surprise, yet he has seen far more clearly than others the real issue, the choice that one must make, the fact that you must either take the whole of revealed religion or none of it. Now, I think that's a terrifically imprudent position to take, not least because Christianity does not have a monopoly of revealed religion. I mean that is, even if you said, well, we're going to limit it to that, if you were really to take the whole of revealed religion, you would, I think, have an incomprehensibly contradictory sense of the world. Just mention one other piece, which is... It's an essay headed In Sincerity and Earnestness, New Britain as I See It. Eliot immediately complains this is a terrible heading for it. He starts with that. But he does. It's not in Gallup, and it's a wonderful, wonderfully interesting statement about how terrible capitalism is in its effects in the 1930s. We must remember that voluntary poverty is a high Christian state, but that involuntary misery or wage slavery is an anti-Christian state. And in condemning usury and love of power, we must avoid the company of people who condemn usury and love of power because they have no inclination towards them. It moves through 360 degrees. It moves all round this question, and I think very fine. Now, I've left myself a little bit of time to talk about Brunetto Latini, so I'll remind you I'm doing this partly because we will honour Peter Hawkins, and he was one of the several very wonderful Dante scholars who were at the university. Now, you'll remember that in this scene with the familiar compound ghost, let me just quote a little bit of it for you. And as I fixed upon the downturned face, that pointed scrutiny with which we challenge the first met stranger in the waning dusk, I caught the sudden look of some dead master whom I had known, forgotten, half recalled, both one and many. In the brown-baked features, the eyes of a familiar compound ghost, both intimate and unidentifiable. So I assumed a double part and cried, and heard another's voice cry, "What? Are you here?" Now, it's manifestly based on the episode which haunted Eliot, which he wrote very beautifully about, not only in the Dante essay, but in Tradition and the Individual Talent. Repeatedly, he kept coming back to the vision, of course, of Brunetto Latini in The Inferno. He says, the quality of surprise. This surprise at its highest could by nothing be better illustrated than by the final lines with which Dante dismisses the damned master whom he loves and respects. And then in translation, I have no Italian, forgive that. Then he turned back and seemed like one of those who run for the green cloth at Verona through the open field, and of them he seemed like one who wins and not like him who loses. Eliot says one does not need to know anything about the race for the role of green cloth to be hit by these lines. And in making Brunetto so fallen run like the winner, a quality is given to the punishment which belongs only to the greatest poetry. And he keeps coming back to that. Now, I want to just say what I think the tension is. The tension is that Eliot does not want to sentimentalise Dante in the Inferno. The essays that he writes, including some that people have recently come across in the TLS, which were not hitherto known, but are unquestionably by Eliot, he repeatedly warning against the sentimentalising or the romanticising of the Inferno and of the people who suffer within the Inferno. And for him, the distinction between the Inferno and Purgatory is, of course, profoundly important, as it had better be. If you take Dante seriously, or indeed take the religion seriously, then the distinction is absolutely crucial. But so the question is Brunetto Latini in Little Gidding truly ensconced in the Inferno and not in Purgatory? What happens is that the scholars of this, including a friend of mine, Eric Griffiths, in Cambridge, wish there to be a clear moment. They wish there to be what they call a pivotal moment when you will move from Brunetto Latini, who is in the Inferno, to Arnaud Daniel, who is in Purgatory. So there's no question but that the end of the speech from the familiar compound ghost is in purgatory. It's quite explicitly in purgatory. But what's the moment when it moves from being in the Inferno? What are you here? That's Sir Brunetto. Sir Brunetto, are you here? The manuscript read and so on. And the brown-baked features are, of course, Brunetto and so on. So there's a funny brown against green play in the whole of that bit. So is there a moment when it clearly moves from the one to the other? So this is what Griffiths and Reynolds say. They identify the pivotal moment, which occurs 16 or 17 lines after, what are you here? These things have served their purpose, let them be. So with your own, and pray they be forgiven by others, as I pray you to forgive both bad and good. That's a wonderful turn, really. You don't have to forgive what's bad, you have to forgive what's good, because it's not good enough, and so on. That's the thought. So the note by Griffiths is, prayer for forgiveness is unknown in Inferno. Brunetto Latini is keen his work should be remembered. These lines mark a pivotal moment in the passage as Eliot moves from the damned Brunetto Latini to the purged Arnaud Daniel. Now, I think that's very telling, but it's not consistent with what they give about lines that come earlier, three or four lines after, what are you here? And he, a face still forming, yet the words sufficed to compel the recognition they preceded. A very beautiful note by Eliot when he's talking to Heywood about this bit. He says, he stands by precede. He wants preceded. He says, I mean to be aware that it is someone you know and to be surprised by his being there before you have identified him. It catches that very, very beautifully. Now, the point about those lines is that they are purgatoria. Him from his aspect had I never guessed, but in his voice was given to me the clue of what was in his countenance, suppressed. So you've got a real problem. When you try, it's like identifying the moment of the fall in Paradise Lost. You find yourself putting earlier and going earlier and going earlier and so on. And there's a problem here about the moment at which it switches from being the one person to be the other. And I feel in the passage, very, very beautifully, a very great wish in the poetry that Brunetto Latini not be in eternal torment. Why do I think that? I think partly because the doctrine of eternal torment, even for somebody who believes in it, is one that people wish also to have some relief and release from. That is the heresy that in the end everybody will be saved. That really there's paradise and there's purgatory. That is a heresy, all right. Though, of course, the invention of purgatory is relatively recent. Isn't that right? So you've got a complication. The purgatory was to deal with the either-or problem. That is, it's inconceivable that you and I would be in there with Hitler. On the other hand, we haven't been as good as Mother Teresa, so maybe there must be some third possibility and so on. So it's the triangulation which we hear about in political terms. But I do think that when you look at the manuscript material, you will find, for instance, that between the lyric Ash on an Old Man's Sleeve and the Dantesque section, you get these lines, fire without and fire within shall purge the unidentified sin. This is the place where we begin. Now, that's purgatory. That's purgatory, and you then meet Brunetto Latini after that. Do you see what I mean? So have you gone purgatory into the Inferno and back again? At least I would urge the claims of an argument which said that Eliot, in a perfectly honourable way, something in him winces from the simple allocation of Brunetto Latini to eternal torment. And it comes out in a remark of his to John Heywood. He's saying, why has he made the change in the speech of the dead master and so on? First reason. The first is that the visionary figure has now become somewhat more definite and will no doubt be identified by some readers with Yeats, though I do not mean anything so precise as that. However, I do not wish to take the responsibility of putting Yeats or anybody else into hell. And I do not want to impute to him the particular vice which took Brunetto there. Though we have, of course, only Dante's word for Brunetto Latini being a sodomite. We know it from Dante. We don't know it from anywhere else. At least that's what the Dante scholars tell me. So that what you've got, I do not wish to take the responsibility of putting Yeats or anybody else into hell. I think hell does double duty because you're never quite sure whether it's inferno or purgatory, but here it means the inferno. And I think there's something, and he says, let me just quote this, although the reference to that canto is intended to be explicit, I wished the effect of the whole to be purgatorial, which is much more appropriate. Now, if you wish the effect of the whole to be much more appropriate, then in some way or other, Brunetto Latini has to be part of the whole. So that, does of the whole mean kind of on the whole, you know, mostly? Or if the effect of the whole, then it would be that something that I would think very, very beautiful, that Eliot resists Dante in this matter. I'll end with a letter that Anthony Hecht wrote to the Dante scholar, R.W.B. Lewis. I was brought up in the old school of hermeneutics, the fourfold reading of Dante as a scripture, and yours is a refreshing liberation from the undeviating solemnity of that school. But your biographical approach, enchanting as it is, raises its own problems. I was struck by this especially in your account of Brunetto Latini. If Brunetto was really not homosexual, if he's placed by Dante in hell with the sodomites simply because Dante feels a sense of rivalry and competitiveness with him, Dante then, by your own thesis that the comedy is an exercise in self-knowledge and self-confrontation, must have realized that he was himself profoundly guilty of one of the seven deadly sins. Moreover, Dante's placement of Brunetto cannot be likened to Ezra Pound's assignment of all those he despises, with a good number of Jews among them, to some inferno of his own making, since Pound clearly does not believe in his own hell and is merely being venomous, whereas Dante has the whole orthodoxy of the Church, the Summa Theologica, canon law, the works, behind his condemnation. To put someone in hell who does not belong there must surely be a sinful act. Even to put someone in the wrong circle of hell is wicked, if you believe and want your readers to believe that the whole order of the cosmos justifies eternal punishments as meted out by their design. So what I'm suggesting is that Eliot has a kind of resistance, puts up a resistance to that, which is why it's so touching. It's not touching simply because of a discrepancy between love and respect and eternal wickedness. Do you know what I mean? It's not just that. There's something in the lines themselves, is there not? The laceration of laughter at what ceases to amuse, but also, of course, the laceration that has to do with an inordinate condemnation. Thank you very much.
This is WBUR. You've been listening to a lecture presented by the Program in Scripture and the Arts in the Department of Religion at Boston University. Speaking was Christopher Ricks, co-director of the Editorial Institute and Warren Professor of the Humanities at Boston University, also professor of poetry at Oxford University. Professor Ricks' lecture was titled Faith in Eliot. We began with an introduction by English Department Professor Matthew Smith. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Jared Mooney. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.